The House on Mango Street, a book of vignettes peering into the Chicago life of Esperanza Cordero, is as popular now as it was when it came out in 1984. Fiction writer, poet, essayist Sandra Cisneros shares her thoughts on this seminal work.
I think that I wrote a story that nourishes and heals the community that happens to be alive at this time. Whether it will do that in the future, I don't know, but I'm very blessed that it's allowing me to have a platform to be heard at this time.
For more than 30 years, Sandra Cisneros has been enriching the American narrative. When President Obama presented her the National Medal of Arts in 2016, he described her ability to educate through her novels, short stories, and poetry, exploring issues of race, class, and gender in the lives of ordinary people straddling multiple cultures. We'll explore her world today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with Sandra Cisneros in 2009 after the 25th anniversary release of her beloved novel, The House on Mango Street.
I wrote it at a time when I was very powerless as a teacher, and I'm very clear that I wrote the book, but its success doesn't have anything to do with me. Mm-hmm. It's about channeling light and getting out of the way. And I really do believe that we as artists, you know, we do the labor, certainly, of collecting that light, but we're not the source of it. And if you're clear about that, you can stay with your feet on the ground for a long time.
Well, the book has been re-released on its 25th anniversary. And so The House on Mango Street has the new foreword that you have written, looking back on it from that vantage point. And there are some wonderful passages through here that I think really speak to the writing life. And I wondered if you wanted to get started with a little piece from your foreword.
You know, when I wrote this introduction, I had to go back to who I used to be. And the way I got into that time was by looking at a photograph of myself while I was writing House in my mid-20s. And I remember that passion, which I still feel, but where it came from so that I could write this novel called The House on Mango Street. When the photo of the young woman who was me was snapped, I still called myself a poet, though I'd been writing stories since grammar school. I'd gravitated back to fiction while in the Iowa Poetry Workshop. Poetry, as it was taught at Iowa, was a house of cards, a tower of ideas. But I can't communicate an idea except through a story. The woman I am in the photo was working on a series of vignettes, little by little, along with her poetry. I already had a title, The House on Mango Street. 50 pages had been written, but I still didn't think of it as a novel. It was just a jar of buttons, like the mismatched embroidered pillowcases and monogrammed napkins I tugged from the bins at the Goodwill. I wrote these things and thought of them as little stories, though I sensed they were connected to each other. I hadn't heard of story cycles yet. I hadn't read Emilio Abreu Gomez's Canek, Elena Poniatowska's Lilus Kikus, Gwendolyn Brooks' Maud Martha, Nelly Campobello's My Mother's Hands. That would come later, when I had more time and solitude to read. The woman I once was wrote the first three stories of House in one weekend at Iowa. But because I wasn't in the fiction workshop, they wouldn't count toward my MFA thesis. I didn't argue. My thesis advisor reminded me too much of my father. I worked on these little stories on the side for comfort when I wasn't writing poetry for credit. I shared them with colleagues like poet Joy Harjo, who was also having a hard time in the poetry workshops, and fiction writer Dennis Mathis, a small-town Illinois native, but whose paperback library was from the world. Little stories were in literary vogue at the time, in the 70s. Dennis told me about the Japanese Nobel Prize winner Kawabata's Minimal Palm of the Hand stories. We fried omelets for dinner and read Garcia Marquez and Heinrich Böll stories aloud. We both preferred experimental writers, all men back then except for Grace Paley, rebels like ourselves. Dennis would become a lifelong editor, ally, and voice on the phone when either of one lost heart. The young woman in the photo is modeling her book in progress after Dream Tigers by Jorge Luis Borges, a writer she'd read since high school, story fragments that ring like Hans Christian Andersen or Ovid or entries from the encyclopedia. She wants to write stories that ignore borders between genres, between written and spoken, between highbrow literature and children's nursery rhymes, between New York and the imaginary village of Macondo, between the U.S. and Mexico. It's true she wants the writer she admires to respect her work, but she also wants people who don't usually read books to enjoy these stories too. She doesn't want to write a book that a reader won't understand and would feel ashamed for not understanding. She thinks stories are about beauty, beauty that is there to be admired by anyone, like a herd of clouds grazing overhead. She thinks people who are busy working for a living deserve beautiful little stories because they don't have much time and are often tired. She has in mind a book that can be opened at any page and will still make sense to the reader who doesn't know what came before or comes after. She experiments, creating a text that is as succinct and flexible as poetry, snapping sentences into fragments so that the reader pauses, making each sentence serve her and not the other way round, abandoning quotation marks to streamline the typography and make the page as simple and readable as possible, so that the sentences are pliant as branches and can be read in more ways than one. Sometimes the woman I once was goes out on weekends to meet with other writers. Sometimes I invite these friends to come to my apartment to workshop each other's work. We come from Black, white, Latino communities. We are men and we are women. What we have in common is our sense that art should serve our communities. Together we publish an anthology, Emergency Tacos, because we finish our collaborations in the early hours before dawn and gather at the same 24-hour taqueria on Belmont Avenue, like a multicultural version of Hopper's Nighthawks painting. The Emergency Tacos writers organize monthly arts events at my brother Keek's apartment, Galeria Quique. We do this with no capital except our valuable time. We do this because the world we live in is a house on fire, and the people we love are burning.
That's just an excerpt of the new preface for The House on Mango Street, released in 2009 as a 25th anniversary edition. And it's by Sandra Cisneros, who's here with me today on New Letters on the Air.
This essay was so hard for me to write. Well, everything's hard for me to write. I'm the pokiest writer in the world. And I just feel like I'm pushing a Buick with my forehead, even if I just write one sentence, let alone a book. So this was hard for me, especially because my mom passed away, and that sadness was in my cells of my body when I wrote it.
Well, and it ends almost with a dedication to her. I mean, it's a beautiful piece.
I didn't expect that my mom would take over this essay, but of course, it makes perfect sense.
That part about stories are about beauty. And I think that's the heart of when we think of something that's literary, even if it may be something awful, there's a beauty that transcends everything.
True. I had thought about it in that way. You know, when I wrote this novel, The House on Mango Street, where I was going with it and who I was trying to be, I was a very young woman in my 20s. I didn't have any political direction. I wasn't a Marxist or a feminist or an anarchist or anyist. I was just this artsy-fartsy person that worked with extremely passionate people at an alternative high school, and everybody was very clear about their politics, and I felt a little bit inferior because I didn't know my isms. And I guess writing House on Mango Street was my political manifesto, because I kept asking, you know, what good is art? And what is the necessity of art? And how can art save lives? And why am I teaching art? Shouldn't I be teaching birth control? You know, maybe I need to get into another line of work, because art seems rather flimsy. But I kept asking those questions as I was, you know, writing my little book at home on weekends and nights. Writing the stories helped me to go to sleep, because I was so roiled by the lives of my students and how impotent I felt as an educator, how small and useless and flimsy, and how my education at an elitist school at the University of Iowa had seemed all wrong, to be so focused on line stops, meter, and publishing, when here I was with a community that was truly suffering. And how could I relieve that suffering? And so I guess I took a little bit of my training as a craftsperson and created what I thought was beautiful, something that could be read by someone at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And yet I wanted to use language so that someone who worked in a factory who needed beauty the most could be nourished by these stories.
And obviously, that's exactly what's happened with this book. The Latino Collective brought you here, and I heard you had an amazing turnout, hundreds of people, over 800 people at the public library.
Yeah.
You become aware of the power of that.
Well, I learned something spiritual with the 25th anniversary, and that is that when you create things from your heart, not your ego, because you don't know whether it's your ego or your heart speaking unless you truly meditate for humility. But when you create something from your corazón and you do it with no ulterior motive, just because you feel so much love for someone other than yourself, and you do it to honor someone other than yourself, it always turns out beautiful. And if you ask the questions, the answers will come. They may not come right away or in the way you expect, but the answers will come. So the answers to that question, what good is art, the book became the answer. And I was like a woman knitting a sweater, you know, and I can only see the little stitch in front of me. I had no idea what I was making. I didn't know if it was a sweater or a lumpy scarf or a doily. I was just doing it because it helped me to get past the moment. And now when I see how the book has reverberated, how it's taught in the schools, especially in the school where I gathered the stories, how it makes sense to women in China or Italy, and how it's saving lives, I have my answer now.
That's wonderful. Is there a particular piece that's like one of the little jewels in the house on Mango Street?
The chapter that I like to read is the smallest chapter in the book. It's called A House of My Own. I always approach audiences that don't like to read. I show them that some of these stories are very tiny, only a paragraph or two. Not a flat, not an apartment in back, not a man's house, not a daddy's. A house all my own, with my porch and my pillow, my pretty purple petunias, my books and my stories, my two shoes waiting beside the bed. Nobody to shake a stick at, nobody's garbage to pick up after. Only a house quiet as snow, a space for myself to go, clean as paper before the poem.
A House of My Own by Sandra Cisneros. I'm Angela Elam, and this is New Letters on the Air. That's like a little poem, actually.
I tried to write the whole book as little poems disguised as fiction, because, you know, people are terrified when they see a poem. They see work. Oh, no, now I have to figure that out. I have to hold it in front of a mirror and hold it upside down and decipher this code. And I didn't want people to think of poetry as work or being obtuse. I wanted them to think of it as a little flower that you could just look at. You don't have to figure out a flower and think, what does that flower mean? Oh, my God. Oh, no, I'm meeting a daisy. No, you just say, Oh, how beautiful. I think I'm going to admire this daisy, and it's going to calm me down. And that's how poems are, too, don't you think?
I do, but I think you're right. I think people are intimidated
that's
by
because
poetry.
Our education system forces people who don't like poetry to teach poetry, and they don't really know what to do with it either.
I find it interesting that you started working on this book in the MFA program at Iowa as a poet, you know, escaping writing your poetry in some ways.
I was avoiding my real voice, and the poems from that age, you can read them in My Wicked, Wicked Ways. They're mainly written in voices and monologues of other characters, and that's because the poems that I wrote in my own voice weren't well received for whatever reason. But mainly, I was too afraid to speak in my own voice. I was censoring myself. So it allowed me to slip on these other personas and speak through, you know, Iowa farmers or waitresses. And House on Manga Street was written in my voice, but my voice 10 years earlier. And that allowed me to get some distance from a story and to say things I couldn't say about my life. I was living in Iowa.
Do you think, too, that the fact that you were in school studying to be a poet and somehow you weren't regarded as a fiction writer at that time, if that freed you? Because no one had expectations about that.
If I had to go back to Iowa and I know what I know now, I would have enrolled in the fiction workshop because I always felt that I was a border crosser. I felt at home in the fiction workshop. I would sometimes ask if I could sit in a class with a friend, and I felt a community there that I didn't feel in the poetry workshop. The poetry workshop was predominantly people that came from a different class than I did, and who had a whole idea of poetics that was different from mine. So I felt out of place and unhappy there. But the fiction workshop seemed to be a mix of classes, and the instructors were more down to earth and didn't seem so full of themselves. And maybe that's not true. Maybe that's just how it appeared to me. But I think I should have been writing fiction and then written poetry on the side. On the other hand, now I like the idea of not classifying my work into one genre or the other. I just feel it all is the same waters all rushing together anyway, so who cares?
Well, I wonder if you might have a poem that you really like reading.
I like the poems in Loose Women that were written without the Iowa Writers' Workshop over my shoulder.
Well, it's funny because I marked one from Loose Women called Night Madness Poem.
Oh, yeah, I like the poems in Loose Women because, you see, the poems in Loose Women were never written for anyone to read in my lifetime. I think the workshop has it wrong. They taught us about publishing our poems, but publishing is the opposite of writing poetry. Because writing a poem is like extricating a thorn from your heart, and it's about getting the thorn out. But publishing is about holding the thorn up and saying, look, 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 look at me. And that's not what writing poetry is about. It's the opposite. So I felt almost as if we had been in an environment where it was presumed we would publish our poems. In the same way that women presumed in the past they were going to have children. But that's a choice you should make. I felt that the poems were polluted by thinking about publication. So I decided to write poetry that was too dangerous, poems that I would throw under the bed, like Emily Dickinson. And something real happened, something more pure, poetry that didn't necessarily hold a flattering light to the writer and that wasn't about prizes or awards. Something more honest came out for me, and I was able to write better poems. But unfortunately, I had to go on a book tour with My Wicked, Wicked Ways, and I thought, oh, no, now I've got to read all this juvenilia. So I would only read the new introduction, and then I'd have like 15 more minutes, and I'd think, what am I going to do? So I pulled out these poems from under the bed, started reading them, and people after the reading would say, where can I get that poem? And I'd say, well, I'll send you a photocopy. Give me your address. But that took a lot of time after a while because there was a lot of people that wanted those poems. So finally I was able to let them go, and I sent them to my agent, and I decided to put them under one cover. They were loose poems, in loose forms from a loose woman, and that's how the title came about, Loose Woman.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, would you like to read one for us?
Yes, I like that book. Night Madness Poem. There's a poem in my head, like too many cups of coffee. A pea under 20 eiderdowns. A sadness in my heart like stone. A telephone. And always my night madness that outs like bats across the Texas sky. I'm the crazy lady they warned you about. The she of rumor talked about. And worse, who talks. It's no secret. I'm here, under a circle of light. The light always on, resisting a glass, an easy cigar. The kind who reels the twilight sky, swoops circling. I'm witch woman high on tobacco and holy water. I'm a woman delighted with her disasters. They give me something to do, a profession of sorts. Keeps me industrious and of some serviceable use. In dreams, the origami of the brain opens like a fist, a pomegranate, an expensive geometry. Not true. I haven't a clue why I'm rumpled tonight. Choose your weapon. Mine, the telephone. My tongue, both black as a gun. I have the magic of words, the power to charm and kill at will. To kill myself, or to aim haphazardly and kill you.
Night Madness Poem, and it's from Sandra Cisneros' book, Loose Woman. And it's also included in a 2004 collection called Vintage Cisneros. I read that there was a piece that you were working on, Acapulco, and you decided it was too much to try to put into this book, Woman Hollering Creek and Other Stories. That is actually
the seed
from which
the novel Caramelo. Yeah, it was a short story that became this big, unwieldy story filled with all kinds of relatives and all kinds of action. And Dennis Mathis, my close friend since Iowa, told me, you don't have a short story here, and that's why you can't finish it. You have the makings of a novel. And instead of saying, a novel, hooray, I said, oh no, a novel. I'm trying to finish this short story collection. I just wasted a month on a novel. Oh no. He said, you know, you'll be happy one day. But that wasn't true. I wasn't happy for 10 years because the book took almost a decade for me to finish, and it was really hard. And every time I felt like crying, I would call him and say, you got me into this, Dennis. Help me get out. So it was a really hard book to write.
It really is what three generations of the Reyes family. Uh-huh. And there's a little snippet that you write right at the beginning of it. It's one of those things that I thought, now this is a writer who really has a sense of what is part of the creative process. So let's have you read that.
Well, the only thing I need to translate is osicona comes from the word osicon, an animal snout. So someone who's an osicon or osicona is a blabbermouth. Disclaim her, or I don't want her, you can have her, she's too osicona for me. The truth. These stories are nothing but story, bits of string, odds and ends found here and there, embroidered together to make something new. I have invented what I do not know and exaggerated what I do to continue the family tradition of telling healthy lies. If in the course of my inventing I have inadvertently stumbled on the truth, perdóneme. To write is to ask questions. It doesn't matter if the answers are true or puro cuento. After all and everything, only the story is remembered, and the truth fades away like the pale blue ink on a cheap embroidery pattern. Eres mi vida. Sueño contigo, mi amor. suspiro por ti, solo tú.
I love that vision of what goes into writing.
We all know as writers that we have to make the story come alive, and you have to exaggerate to make the story better. And the parts that you can't remember, you have to invent. And then later on, you'll find out from your family, oh, that really did happen. It's all todo al contrario, all reverse. And the parts you think that happened, you invented. Or sometimes we think we dreamt something, and you'll tell the story, and a family member will say, no, that really happened. I was there.
Yeah, I think it does happen.
But I think there are dreams, and then there are things that really happen, and they all swirl and mix, and they're part of our childhood. And when we write, we go into our past and in our dreams and into our daydreams, and they're all true to me. And it doesn't matter whether it really happened to you or to me. That story passed through me and nourished me, so it becomes mine.
Tell me a little bit about your process when you write. Are you one of these people who gets up in the morning and writes right after you come out of dreams? Do you write at night? I read that you're a creature of the night sometimes.
Well, I try to write soon after I become vertical, but I have a lot of animals and a lot of responsibilities. You know, there's parrots and dogs, and it's like a farm in my house, even though I live in the city. And then I tend to take a long time eating breakfast, and people come to my house that work for me or are visiting. And so I try not to talk on the days I write. And then I eat breakfast, and the next thing you know, it's 1 o'clock. How did that happen? I don't know. But usually I go to my desk about 1 o'clock. And I start working. I really don't know where to begin, so I dig around in my writing in progress pile, which I guess would be the same as a woman's sewing basket. I look in there and I find something that's pretty, that I feel excited about, that's almost done, or something that could be done. And whatever is most exciting that day, I try to make it come to life. And that's my writing day. And I generally work in my office with my dogs, and they remind me to take a break, and they want love transfusions, and they want to be told they're wonderful and to be hugged. And that's good, because you need to look up every once in a while. And then I go out to the balcony with them, and sometimes we look at the river and the birds. And you try to work as much as possible before sunset, because then the dogs say it's our time, we need to go for a walk. And then it's dinner time, and the day ended, and it's time to watch a movie.
The place that you described at the end of your new foreword to the house of Mango Street, where you go up to the roof of your house with your mother.
Yes.
Is that the house you live in now?
That's my office, yes.
I thought,
my library's on the first floor. And I write on the second, and I have a little balcony that I can keep the doors open if it's not too hot. If I have time, I go all the way up to the terrace. I usually do that about rush hour, because when the neighborhood comes to life, watch the sunset. It's very nice and peaceful to be up there. Nobody knows you're there. You could be sad, and you could cry, and you could laugh. And the only one that's there to hear you are the dogs, and they're very sweet and understanding. So that's what you need when you write, of a space so that no one can hear you laugh or cry. And you should have a dog with sad, watery eyes next to you. That always helps.
Sandra Cisneros in 2009, talking about the house that was the original site for the Macondo Foundation, where the Writer's Workshop began in homage to Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. For links to that, the house on Mango Street, and more about her National Medal of Arts, one of the last awarded back in 2016, go to newletters.org and search for Sandra Cisneros. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Eric Motter, Molly Lesher, Dennis Conroe, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.